The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, I'm Rosina Chevalier, and today I will be reading Camino Island by John Grisham. Copyright date 2017, published by Belfry Holdings. First, a word about the author. John Grisham is the author of 30 novels, one work of nonfiction, a collection of stories, and 6 novels for young readers. Other books by this author include A Time to Kill, The Firm, The Pelican Brief, The Client, The Chamber, The Rainmaker, The Runaway Jury, The Partner, The Street Lawyer, The Testament, The Brethren, A Painted House, Skipping Christmas, The Summons, The King of Torts, Bleachers, The Last Juror, The Broker, The Innocent Man, Playing for Pizza, The Appeal, The Associate, Ford County, The Confession, The Litigators, Calico Joe, The Racketeer, Sycamore Row, Gray Mountain, Rogue Lawyer, and The Whistler. Here is a synopsis from the book jacket. A gang of thieves stage a daring heist from a secure vault deep below Princeton University's Firestone Library. Their loot is priceless, but Princeton has insured it for $25 million. Bruce Cable owns a popular bookstore in the sleepy resort town of Santa Rosa on Camino Island in Florida. He makes his real money, though, as a prominent dealer in rare books. Very few people know that he occasionally dabbles in the black market of stolen books and manuscripts. Mercer Mann is a young novelist with a severe case of writer's block who has recently been laid off from her teaching position. She is approached by an elegant, mysterious woman working for an even more mysterious company. A generous offer of money convinces Mercer to go undercover and infiltrate Bruce Cable's circle of literary friends, ideally getting close enough to him to learn his secrets. But eventually, Mercer learns far too much, and there's trouble in paradise, as only John Grisham can deliver it. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. Now let's begin with Camino Island. Chapter 1, The Heist. The imposter borrowed the name of Neville Manchin, an actual professor of American literature at Portland State and soon-to-be doctoral student at Stanford. In his letter on perfectly forged college stationery, Professor Manchin claimed to be a budding scholar of F. Scott Fitzgerald and was keen to see the great writer's manuscripts and papers during a forthcoming trip to the East Coast. The letter was addressed to Dr. Jeffrey Brown, Director of Manuscripts Division, Department of Rare Books and Special Collections, Firestone Library, Princeton University. It arrived with a few others, was duly sorted and passed along, and eventually landed on the desk of Ed Folk, a career junior librarian whose task, among several other monotonous ones, was to verify the credentials of the person who wrote the letter. Ed received several of these letters each week, all in many ways the same, all from self-proclaimed Fitzgerald buffs and experts, and even from the occasional true scholar. In the previous calendar year, Ed had cleared and logged 190 of these people through the library. They came from all over the world and arrived wide-eyed and humbled, like pilgrims before a shrine. In his 34 years at the same desk, Ed had processed all of them, and they were not going away. F. Scott Fitzgerald continued to fascinate. The traffic was as heavy now as it had been 3 decades earlier. These days, though, Ed was wondering what could possibly be left of the great writer's life that had not been pored over, studied at great length, and written about. Not long ago, a true scholar told Ed that there were now at least 100 books and over 10,000 published academic articles on Fitzgerald the man, the writer, his works, and his crazy wife. And he drank himself to death at 44. What if he'd lived into old age and kept writing? Ed would need an assistant, maybe two, perhaps an entire staff. But then Ed knew that an early death was often the key to later acclaim, not to mention greater royalties. After a few days, Ed finally got around to dealing with Professor Manchin. A quick review of the library's register revealed that this was a new person, a new request. Some of the veterans had been to Princeton so many times, they simply called his number and said, "Hey, Ed, I'll be there next Tuesday," which was fine with Ed. Not so with Manchin. Ed went through the Portland State website and found his man, undergraduate degree in American Lit, from the University of Oregon, master's from UCLA, adjunct gig now for 3 years. His photo revealed a rather plain-looking young man of perhaps 35, the makings of a beard that was probably temporary, and narrow, frameless eyeglasses. In his letter, Professor Manchin asked whoever responded to do so by email and gave a private Gmail address. He said he rarely checked his university address. Ed thought, "That's because you're just a lowly adjunct professor and probably don't even have a real office." He often had these thoughts, but, of course, was too professional to utter them to anyone else. Out of caution, the next day he sent a response through the Portland State server. He thanked Professor Manchin for his letter and invited him to the Princeton campus. He asked for a general idea of when he might arrive and laid out a few of the basic rules regarding the Fitzgerald collection. There were many, and he suggested that Professor Manchin study them on the library's website. The reply was automatic and informed Ed that Manchin was out of pocket for a few days. One of Manchin's partners had hacked into the Portland State Directory just deep enough to tamper with the English department's email server. Easy work for a sophisticated hacker. He and the imposter knew immediately that Ed had responded. Ho-hum, thought Ed. The next day he sent the same message to Professor Manchin's private Gmail address. Within an hour, Manchin replied with an enthusiastic thank you, said he couldn't wait to get there, and so on. He gushed on about how he had studied the library's website, had spent hours with the Fitzgerald Digital Archives, had owned for years the multi-volume series containing facsimile editions of the great author's handwritten first drafts, and had a particular interest in the critical reviews of the first novel, This Side of Paradise. "Great," said Ed. He'd seen it all before. The guy was trying to impress him before he even got there, which was not at all unusual. F. Scott Fitzgerald enrolled in Princeton in the fall of 1913. At the age of 16, he was dreaming of writing the great American novel, and had indeed begun working on an early version of This Side of Paradise. He dropped out 4 years later to join the Army and go to war, but it ended before he was deployed. His classic, The Great Gatsby, was published in 1925, but did not become popular until after his death. He struggled financially throughout his career, and by 1940 was working in Hollywood, cranking out bad screenplays, failing physically and creatively. On December 21st, he died of a heart attack brought on by years of severe alcoholism. In 1950, Scotty, his daughter and only child, gave his original manuscripts, notes, and letters, his papers, to the Firestone Library at Princeton. His five novels were handwritten on inexpensive paper that did not age well. The library quickly realized that it would be unwise to allow researchers to physically handle them. High-quality copies were made, and the originals were locked away in a secured basement vault where the air, light, and temperature were carefully controlled. Over the years, they had been removed only a handful of times. The man posing as Professor Neville Manchin arrived at Princeton on a beautiful fall day in early October. He was directed to rare books and special collections, where he met Ed Folk, who then passed him along to another assistant librarian who examined and copied his Oregon driver's license. It was, of course, a forgery, but a perfect one. The forger, who was also the hacker, had been trained by the CIA and had a long history in the murky world of private espionage. Breaching a bit of campus security was hardly a challenge. Professor Manchin was then photographed and given a security badge that had to be displayed at all times. He followed the assistant librarian to the second floor, to a large room with two long tables and walls lined with retractable steel drawers, each of which was locked. Manchin noticed at least four surveillance cameras high in the corners, cameras that were supposed to be seen. He suspected others were well hidden. He attempted to chat up the assistant librarian, but got little in return. He jokingly asked if he could see the original manuscript for This Side of Paradise. The assistant librarian offered a smug grin and said that would not be possible. "Have you ever seen the originals?" Manchin asked. "Only once." A pause as Manchin waited for more. Then he asked, "And what was the occasion?" "Well, a certain famous scholar wished to see them. We accompanied him down to the vault and gave him a look. He didn't touch the papers, though. Only our head librarian is allowed to do so, and only with special gloves." "Of course. Oh, well, let's get to work." The assistant opened two of the large drawers, both labeled This Side of Paradise, and withdrew thick, oversized notebooks. He said, "These contain the reviews of the book when it was first published. We have many other samples of later reviews." "Perfect," Manchin said with a grin. He opened his briefcase, took out a notepad, and seemed ready to pounce on everything laid on the table. Half an hour later, with Manchin deep in his work, the assistant librarian excused himself and disappeared. For the benefit of the cameras, Manchin never looked up. Eventually, he needed to find the men's room and wandered away. He took a wrong turn here and another one there, got himself lost, and eased through collections, avoiding contact with anyone. There were surveillance cameras everywhere. He doubted that anyone at that moment was watching the footage, but it could certainly be retrieved if needed. He found an elevator, avoided it, and took the nearby stairs. The first level below was similar to the ground floor. Below it, the stairs stopped at B2, basement 2, where a large thick door waited with "Emergencies Only" painted in bold letters. A keypad was next to the door, and another sign warned that an alarm would sound the instant the door was opened without proper authorization. Two security cameras watched the door and the area around it. Manchin backed away and retraced his steps. When he returned to his workroom, the assistant was waiting. "Is everything okay, Professor Manchin?" he asked. "Oh, yes, just a bit of a stomach bug, I'm afraid. Hope it's not contagious." The assistant librarian left immediately, and Manchin hung around all day, digging through materials from the steel drawers and reading old reviews he cared nothing about. Several times he wandered off, poking around, looking, measuring, and memorizing. Manchin returned 3 weeks later, and he was no longer pretending to be a professor. He was clean-shaven. His hair was colored a sandy blonde. He wore fake eyeglasses with red frames, and he carried a bogus student card with a photo. If someone asked, which he certainly didn't expect, his story was that he was a grad student from Iowa. In real life, his name was Mark, and his occupation, if one could call it that, was professional thievery. High-dollar, world-class, elaborately planned, smash-and-grab jobs that specialized in art and rare artifacts that could be sold back to the desperate victims for ransom. His was a gang of five, led by Denny, a former Army Ranger, who had turned to crime after being kicked out of the military. So far, Denny had not been caught and had no record, nor did Mark. However, two of the others did. Trey had two convictions and two escapes, his last the year before from a federal prison in Ohio. It was there he'd met Jerry, a petty art thief now on parole. Another art thief, a one-time cellmate serving a long sentence, had first mentioned the Fitzgerald manuscripts to Jerry. The setup was perfect. There were only five manuscripts, all handwritten, all in one place, and to Princeton they were priceless. The fifth member of the team preferred to work at home. Ahmed was the hacker, the forger, the creator of all illusions, but he didn't have the nerve to carry guns and such. He worked from his basement in Buffalo and had never been caught or arrested. He left no trails. His 5% would come off the top. The other four would take the rest in equal shares. By 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night, Denny, Mark, and Jerry were inside the Firestone Library, posing as grad students and watching the clock. Their fake student IDs had worked perfectly. Not a single eyebrow had been raised. Denny found his hiding place in a third-floor women's restroom. He lifted a panel in the ceiling above the toilet, tossed up his student backpack, and settled in for a few hours of hot and cramped waiting. Mark picked the lock of the main mechanical room on the first level of the basement and waited for alarms. He heard none, nor did Ahmed, who had easily hacked into the university's security systems. Mark proceeded to dismantle the fuel injectors of the library's backup electrical generator. Jerry found a spot in a study corral hidden among rows of stacked tiers holding books that had not been touched in decades. Trey was drifting around the campus, dressed like a student, lugging his backpack, scoping out places for his bombs. The library closed at midnight. The four team members, as well as Ahmed in his basement in Buffalo, were in radio contact. Denny, the leader, announced at 12:15 that all was proceeding as planned. At 12:20, Trey, dressed like a student and hauling a bulky backpack, entered the McCarran Residential College in the heart of the campus. He saw the same surveillance cameras he had seen the previous week. He took the unwatched stairs to the second floor, ducked into a co-ed restroom, and locked himself in a stall. At 12:40, he reached into his backpack and removed a tin can about the size of a 20-ounce bottle of soda. He set a delayed starter and hid it behind the toilet. He left the restroom and went to the third floor and set another bomb in an empty shower stall. At 12:45, he found a semi-dark hallway on the second floor of a dormitory and nonchalantly tossed a string of 10 jumbo black cat firecrackers down the hall. As he scrambled down the stairwell, the explosions boomed through the air. Seconds later, both smoke bombs erupted, sending thick clouds of rancid fog into the hallways. As Trey left the building, he heard the first wave of panicked voices. He stepped behind some shrubs near the dorm, pulled a disposable phone out of his pocket, called Princeton's 911 service, and delivered the horrifying news. There's a guy with a gun on the second floor of McCarran. He's firing shots. Smoke was drifting from a second-floor window. Jerry, sitting in a dark study corral in the library, made a similar call from his prepaid cell phone. Soon, calls were pouring in as panic gripped the campus. Every American college has elaborate plans to handle a situation involving an active gunman, but no one wants to implement them. It took a few dumbstruck seconds for the officer in charge to push the right buttons, but when she did, sirens began wailing. Every Princeton student, professor, administrator, and employee received a text and email alert. All doors were to be closed and locked. All buildings were to be secured. Jerry made another call to 911 and reported that two students had been shot. Smoke boiled out of McCarran Hall. Trey dropped three more smoke bombs into trash cans. A few students ran through the smoke as they went from building to building, not sure where exactly the safe places were. Campus security and the City of Princeton police raced onto the scene, followed closely by half a dozen fire trucks, then ambulances. The first of many patrol cars from the New Jersey State Police arrived. Trey left his backpack at the door of an office building, then called 911 to report how suspicious it looked. The timer on the last smoke bomb inside the backpack was set to go off in 10 minutes, just as the demolition experts would be staring at it from a distance. At 1:05, Trey radioed the gang. "A perfect panic out here. Smoke everywhere. Tons of cops. Go for it." Danny replied, "Cut the lights." Ahmed, sipping strong tea in Buffalo and sitting on go, quickly routed through the school's security panel, entered the electrical grid, and cut the electricity not only to the Firestone Library, but to half a dozen nearby buildings as well. For good measure, Mark, now wearing night vision goggles, pulled the main cutoff switch in the mechanical room. He waited and held his breath, then breathed easier when the backup generator did not engage. The power outage triggered alarms at the central monitoring station inside the campus security complex, but no one was paying attention. There was an active gunman on the loose. There was no time to worry about other alarms. Jerry had spent two nights inside the Firestone Library in the past week and was confident there were no guards stationed within the building while it was closed. During the night, a uniformed officer walked around the building once or twice, shined his flashlight at the doors, and kept walking. A marked patrol car made its rounds too, but it was primarily concerned with drunk students. Generally, the campus was like any other, dead between the hours of 1 and 8 a.m. On this night, however, Princeton was in the midst of a frantic emergency as America's finest were being shot. Trey reported to his gang that that the scene was total chaos with cops scrambling about, SWAT boys throwing on their gear, sirens screaming, radios squawking, and a million red and blue emergency lights flashing. Smoke hung by the trees like a fog. A helicopter could be heard hovering somewhere close. Total chaos. Denny, Jerry, and Mark hustled through the dark and took the stairs down to the basement under special collections. Each wore night vision goggles and a miner's lamp strapped to his forehead. Each carried a heavy backpack, and Jerry hauled a small army duffel he'd hidden away in the library two nights earlier. At the third and final level down, they stopped at a thick metal door, blacked out the surveillance cameras, and waited for Ahmed and his magic. Calmly, he worked his way through the library's alarm system and deactivated the door's four sensors. There was a loud clicking noise. Denny pressed down on the handle and pulled the door open. Inside, they found a narrow square of space with two more metal doors. Using a flashlight, Mark scanned the ceiling and spotted a surveillance camera. "There," he said, "only one." Jerry, the tallest at 6'3", took a small can of black paint and sprayed the lens of the camera. Denny looked at the two doors and said, "Want to flip a coin?" "What do you see?" Ahmed asked from Buffalo. "Two metal doors, identical," Denny replied. "I got nothing here, fellas," Ahmed replied. "There's nothing in the system beyond the first door. Start cutting." From his duffel, Jerry removed two 18-inch canisters, one filled with oxygen, the other with acetylene. Denny situated himself before the door on the left, lit a cutting torch with a sparker, and began heating a spot 6 inches above the keyhole and latch. Within seconds, sparks were flying. Meanwhile, Trey had drifted away from the chaos around McCarran and was hiding in the blackness across the street from the library. Sirens were screaming as more emergency vehicles responded. Helicopters were thumping the air loudly above the campus, though Trey could not see them. Around him, even the streetlights were out. There was not another soul near the library. All hands were needed elsewhere. "All's quiet outside the library," he reported. "Any progress?" "We're cutting now," came the terse reply from Mark. All five members knew that chatter should be limited. Denny slowly and skillfully cut through the metal with a torch tip that emitted 800 degrees of oxygenated heat. Minutes passed as molten metal dripped to the floor and red and yellow sparks flew from the door. At one point, Denny said, "It's an inch thick." He finished the top edge of the square and began cutting straight down. The work was slow. The minutes dragged on, and the tension mounted, but they kept their cool. Jerry and Mark crouched behind Denny, watching his every move. When the bottom cut line was finished, Denny rattled the latch and it came loose, though something hung. "It's a bolt," he said. "I'll cut it." 5 minutes later, the door swung open. Ahmed, staring at his laptop, noticed nothing unusual from the library's security system. "Nothing here," he said. Denny, Mark, and Jerry entered the room and immediately filled it. A narrow table, 2 feet wide at most, ran the length about 10 feet. Four large wooden drawers covered one side, four on the other. Mark, the lock picker, flipped up his goggles, adjusted his headlight, and inspected one of the locks. He shook his head and said, "No surprise. Combination locks, probably with computerized codes that change every day. There's no way to pick it. We gotta drill." "Go for it," Danny said. "Start drilling and I'll cut the other door." Jerry produced a 3/4 drive battery-powered drill with bracing bars on both sides. He zeroed in on the lock, and he and Mark applied as much pressure as possible. The drill whined and slid off the brass, which at first seemed impenetrable. But a shaving spun off, then another. And as the men shoved the bracing bars, the drill bit ground deeper into the lock. When it gave way, the drawer still would not open. Mark managed to slide a thin pry bar into the gap above the lock and yanked down violently. The wood frame split and the drawer opened. Inside was an archival storage box with black metal edges, 17 inches by 22 and 3 inches deep. "Careful," Jerry said as Mark opened the box and gently lifted the thin, hardback volume. Mark read slowly, "The Collected Poems of Dolph McKenzie." "Just what I always wanted." "Who the hell?" "Don't know, but we ain't here for poetry." Denny entered behind them and said, "Okay, get on with it. 7 more drawers in here. I'm almost inside the other room." They returned to their labors as Trey casually smoked a cigarette on a park bench across the street and glanced repeatedly at his watch. The frenzy across the campus showed no signs of dying down, but it wouldn't last forever. The second and third drawers in the first room revealed more rare books by authors unknown to the gang. When Denny finished cutting his way into the second room, he told Jerry and Mark to bring the drill. This room, too, had 8 large drawers, seemingly identical to the first room. At 2:15, Trey checked in with a report that the campus was still in lockdown, but curious students were beginning to gather on the lawn in front of McCarran to watch the show. Police with bullhorns had ordered them back to their rooms, but there were too many to handle. At least 2 news helicopters were hovering and complicating things. He was watching CNN on his smartphone, and the Princeton story was the story of the moment. A frantic reporter on the scene continually referred to unconfirmed casualties and managed to convey the impression that numerous students had been shot by at least 1 gunman. "At least 1 gunman," Trey mumbled. "Doesn't every shooting require at least 1 gunman?" Denny, Mark, and Jerry discussed the idea of cutting into the drawers with a blowtorch, but decided against it for the moment anyway. The risk of fire would be high, and what good would the manuscripts be if they were damaged? Instead, Denny pulled out a smaller 1/4 drive drill and began drilling. Mark and Jerry bored away with the larger one. The first drawer in the second room produced stacks of delicate papers handwritten by another long-forgotten poet, one they'd never heard of but hated nonetheless. At 2:30, CNN confirmed that 2 students were dead and at least 2 more were injured. The word carnage was introduced. When the second floor of McCarran was secured, the police noticed the remnants of what appeared to be firecrackers. The empty smoke bomb canisters were found in the restroom and the shower. Trey's abandoned backpack was opened by a demolition crew, and the spent smoke bomb was removed. At 3:10, the commander first mentioned the word prank, but the adrenaline was still pumping so fast, no one thought of the word diversion. The rest of McCarran was quickly secured, and all students were accounted for. The campus was still locked down, and would remain so for hours as the nearby buildings were searched. At 3:30, Trey reported, "Things seem to be settling down out here. 3 hours in, fellas. How's the drilling?" "Slow," came the one-word response from Denny. Inside the vault, the work was indeed slow, but determined. The first 4 open drawers revealed more old manuscripts, some handwritten, some typed, all by important writers who didn't matter at the moment. They finally struck gold in the fifth drawer when Denny removed an archival storage box identical to the others. He carefully opened it. A reference page inserted by the library read, "Original handwritten manuscript of The Beautiful and Damned, F. Scott Fitzgerald." "Bingo," Denny said calmly. He removed two identical boxes from the fifth drawer, delicately placed them on the narrow table, and opened them. Inside were the original manuscripts of Tender is the Night and The Last Tycoon. Ahmed, still glued to his laptop and now drinking a highly caffeinated energy drink, heard the beautiful words. "Okay, boys, we have 3 out of 5. Gatsby's here somewhere, along with Paradise." Trey asked, "How much longer?" 20 minutes, Denny said. "Get the van." Trey casually strode across the campus, mixed in with a crowd of the curious, and watched for a moment as the small army of policemen milled about. They were no longer ducking, covering, running, and dashing behind cars with loaded weapons. The danger had clearly passed, though the area was still ablaze with flashing lights. Trey eased away, walked half a mile, left the campus, and stopped at John Street, where he got into a white cargo van with the words, "Princeton University Printing," stenciled on both front doors. It was number 12, whatever that meant, and it was very similar to a van Trey had photographed a week earlier. He drove it back onto campus, avoided the commotion around McCarran, and parked it by a loading ramp at the rear of the library. "Van in place," he reported. "We're just opening the sixth drawer," Denny replied. As Jerry and Mark flipped up their goggles and moved their lights closer to the table, Denny gently opened the archival storage box. Its reference sheet read, "Original handwritten manuscript of The Great Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald." "Bingo," he said calmly. "We got Gatsby, that old son of a bitch." "Whoopee," Mark said, though their excitement was thoroughly contained. Jerry lifted out the only other box in the drawer. It was the manuscript for This Side of Paradise, Fitzgerald's first novel, published in 1920. "We have all 5. Denny said calmly, "Let's get out of here." Jerry repacked the drills, the cutting torch, the canisters of oxygen and acetylene, and the pry bars. As he bent to lift the duffel, a piece of splintered wood from the third drawer nicked him above his left wrist. In the excitement, he barely noticed and just rubbed it for a split second as he removed his backpack. Denny and Mark carefully placed the 5 priceless manuscripts into their 3 student backpacks. The thieves hustled from the vault, laden with their loot and tools, and scampered up the stairs to the main floor. They left the library through a service entrance near a delivery ramp, one hidden from view by a thick, long hedge. They jumped through the rear doors of the van, and Trey pulled away from the ramp. As he did so, he passed 2 campus security guards in a patrol car. He flicked a casual wave. They did not respond. Trey noted the time, 3:42 a.m. He reported, "All clear. Leaving the campus now with Mr. Gatsby and friends." The power outage triggered several alarms in the affected buildings. By 4 a.m., an electrical engineer had worked his way through the school's computer grid and found the problem. Electricity was restored in all buildings except the library. The chief of security sent 3 officers to the library. It took them 10 minutes to find the cause of the alarm. By then, the gang had stopped at a cheap motel off Interstate 295 near Philadelphia. Trey parked the van beside an 18-wheeler and away from the lone camera monitoring the parking lot. Mark took a can of white spray paint and covered the Princeton University printing on both of the van's doors. In a room where he and Trey had stayed the night before, the men quickly changed into hunting outfits and crammed everything they'd worn for the job, jeans, sneakers, sweatshirts, black gloves, into another duffel. In the bathroom, Jerry noticed the small cut on his left wrist. He had kept a thumb on it during the ride and noted that there was more blood than he'd realized. He wiped it clean with a bath cloth and debated whether to mention it to the others. Not now, maybe later. They quietly removed all their stuff from the room, turned off the lights, and left. Mark and Jerry got into a pickup truck, a fancy club cab, leased and driven by Denny, and they followed Trey and the van out of the parking lot, onto the street, then back onto the interstate. They skirted the northern edge of the Philadelphia suburbs and, using state highways, disappeared into the Pennsylvania countryside. Near Quakertown, they found the county road they had chosen and followed it for a mile until it turned to gravel. There were no houses in the area. Trey parked the van in a shallow ravine, removed the stolen license plates, poured a gallon of gasoline over their bags filled with the tools, cell phones, radio equipment, and clothing, and lit a match. The fireball was instant, and as they drove away in the pickup, they were confident they had destroyed all possible evidence. The manuscripts were safely tucked between Trey and Mark on the rear seat of the pickup. As daylight slowly crept over the hills, they rode in silence, each of the four observing everything around them, which was very little. An occasional vehicle passing in the other direction, a farmer headed to his barn and not looking at the highway, an old woman collecting a cat off the front porch. Near Bethlehem, they merged onto Interstate 78 and headed west. Denny stayed well under the speed limit. They had not seen a police car since leaving the Princeton campus. They stopped at a drive-thru for chicken biscuits and coffee and headed north on Interstate 81 toward the Scranton area. The first pair of FBI agents arrived at the Firestone Library just after 7 a.m. They were briefed by campus security and the Princeton City Police. They took a look at the crime scene and suggested strongly that the library remain closed indefinitely. Investigators and technicians from the Trenton office were hurrying to the school. The president of the university had just returned to his home on campus after a very long night when he got the news that some valuables were missing. He raced to the library where he met with the chief librarian, the FBI, and the local police. Together, they made the decision to keep a lid on the story for as long as possible. The head of the FBI's Rare Asset Recovery Unit in Washington was on the way, and it was his opinion that the thieves might contact the school quickly and want a deal. Publicity, and there would be an avalanche of it, would only complicate matters. The celebration was postponed until the four hunters arrived at the cabin deep in the Poconos. Denny had leased the small A-frame for the hunting season, with funds that would be repaid when they cashed in, and had been living there for 2 months. Of the four, only Jerry had a permanent address. He'd been renting a small apartment with his girlfriend in Rochester, New York. Trey, as an escapee, had been living on the run most of his adult life. Mark lived part-time with an ex-wife near Baltimore, but there were no records to prove it. All four had multiple forms of fake identification, including passports that would fool any customs agent. Three bottles of cheap champagne were in the fridge. Denny opened one, emptied it into four mismatched coffee cups, and offered a hearty, "Cheers, boys, and congratulations, we did it." The three bottles were gone in half an hour, and the weary hunters fell into long naps. The manuscripts, still in the identical archival storage boxes, were stacked like bricks of gold in a gun safe in the storage room, where they would be guarded by Denny and Trey for the next few days. Tomorrow, Jerry and Mark would drift back home, exhausted from a long week in the woods hunting deer. While Jerry slept, the full weight and fury of the federal government was moving rapidly against him. An FBI technician noticed a tiny spot on the first step of the stairway leading to and from the library's vault. She thought, correctly, that it was a drop of blood and that it had not been there long enough to turn dark maroon, almost black. She gathered it, told her supervisor, and the sample was rushed to an FBI lab in Philadelphia. DNA testing was done immediately, and the results were rammed into the National Data Bank. In less than an hour, it tagged a match in Massachusetts, one Gerald A. Steengarden, a paroled felon convicted 7 years earlier of stealing paintings from an art dealer in Boston. A squad of analysts worked feverishly to find any trace of Mr. Steengarden. There were at least five in the U.S. Four were quickly eliminated. Search warrants for the apartment, cell phone records, and credit cards of the fifth Mr. Steengarden were obtained. When Jerry woke up from his long nap deep in the Poconos, the FBI was already watching his apartment in Rochester. The decision was made not to go in with a warrant, but to watch and wait. Maybe, just maybe, Mr. Steengarden would lead them to the others. Back at Princeton, lists were being made of all students who had used the library in the past week. Their ID cards recorded each visit to any of the libraries on campus. The fake ones stood out because in college, fake IDs were used for the underage purchase of alcohol, not to sneak into libraries. The exact times of their use were determined, then matched against video footage from the library's surveillance cameras. By noon, the FBI had clear images of Denny, Jerry, and Mark, though these would prove to be of little value at the moment. All were well disguised. In Rare Books and Special Collections, old Ed Folk snapped into high gear for the first time in decades. Surrounded by FBI agents, he raced through the login registers and security photos of his recent visitors. Each one was called for verification, and when Adjunct Professor Neville Manchin at Portland State spoke to the FBI, he assured them he had never been near the Princeton campus. The FBI had a clear photo of Mark, though they did not know his real name. Less than 12 hours after the heist was successfully completed, 40 FBI agents were grinding away, poring over videos and analyzing data. Late in the afternoon, the four hunters gathered around a card table and opened beers. Denny rambled on and covered ground they had gone over a dozen times. The heist was over. It was a success. But in any crime, clues are left behind. Mistakes are always made. And if you can think of half of them, then you're a genius. The fake IDs would soon be discovered and picked over. The cops would know they had cased the library for days before the heist. Who knew how much damning video footage existed? There could be fibers from their clothing, prints from their sneakers, and so on. They were confident they'd left no fingerprints behind, but there was always that possibility. The four were seasoned thieves, and they knew all this. The small band-aid above Jerry's left wrist had not been noticed, and he had decided to ignore it, too. He had convinced himself it was of no consequence. Mark produced four devices identical to the Apple iPhone 5, complete with the company's logo, but they were not phones. Instead, they were known as SatTracks, tracking devices tied to a satellite system with instant coverage anywhere in the world. There was no cell phone network, no way for the cops to track them or eavesdrop in any way. Mark explained again that it was imperative for the four, plus Ahmed, to remain in constant contact over the next few weeks. Ahmed had obtained the devices from one of his many sources. There was no on-off switch, but instead a three-digit code to activate the SatTracks. Once the device was turned on, each user punched in his own five-digit password to gain access. Twice each day at exactly 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., the five would hook up through the devices with the simple message of clear. Delays were inexcusable and perhaps catastrophic. A delay meant the SatTrack, and especially its user, had been compromised in some manner. A delay of 15 minutes activated Plan B, which called for Denny and Trey to grab the manuscripts and move to a second safe house. If either Denny or Trey failed to report, the entire operation, or what was left of it, was to be aborted. Jerry, Mark, and Ahmed were to leave the country immediately. Bad news was transmitted by the simple message, red. Red meant, with no questions asked and no time for delay, that 1. Something has gone wrong. 2. If possible, get the manuscripts to the third safe house. And 3. By all means, get out of the country as quickly as possible. If anyone was nabbed by the cops, silence was expected. The five had memorized the names of family members and their addresses to ensure complete loyalty to the cause and to each other. Retaliation was guaranteed. No one would talk, ever. As ominous as these preparations were, the mood was still light, even celebratory. They had pulled off a brilliant crime and made a perfect escape. Trey, the serial escapee, relished telling his stories. He was successful because he had a plan after each escape, whereas most guys spent their time thinking only of getting out. Same with a crime. You spend days and weeks planning and plotting, then when it's done, you're not sure what to do next. They needed a plan. But they couldn't agree on one. Denny and Mark favored the quick strike, which entailed making contact with Princeton within a week and demanding a ransom. They could get rid of the manuscripts and not have to worry about protecting and moving them, and they could get their cash. Jerry and Trey, with more experience, favored a patient approach. Let the dust settle. Let the reality set in as word crept through the black market. Allow some time to pass so they could be certain they were not suspects. Princeton was not the only possible buyer. Indeed, there would be others. The discussion was long and often tense, but also punctuated with jokes and laughter and no shortage of beer. They finally agreed on a temporary plan. Jerry and Mark would leave the following morning for home. Jerry to Rochester, Mark to Baltimore by way of Rochester. They would lie low and watch the news for the next week, and of course check in with the team twice a day. Denny and Trey would handle the manuscripts and move them in a week or so to the second safe house, a cheap apartment in a grungy section of Allentown, Pennsylvania. In 10 days, they would reunite with Jerry and Mark at the safe house, and the four would hammer out a definite plan. In the meantime, Mark would contact a potential middleman he had known for many years, a player in the shady world of stolen art and artifacts. Speaking in the hushed code of the trade, he would let it be known that he knew something about the Fitzgerald manuscripts, but nothing more would be said until they met again. Carol, the woman living in Jerry's apartment, left at 4:30 alone. She was followed to a grocery store a few blocks away. The quick decision was made not to enter the apartment, not at that time. There were too many neighbors nearby. One word from one of them and their surveillance could be compromised. Carol had no idea how closely she was being watched. While she shopped, agents placed two tracking devices inside the bumpers of her car. Two more agents, females in jogging suits, monitored what she purchased, nothing of interest. When she texted her mother, the text was read and recorded. When she called her friend, agents listened to every word. When she stopped at a bar, an agent in jeans offered to buy her a drink. When she returned home just after 9, every step was watched, filmed, and recorded. Meanwhile, her boyfriend sipped beer and read The Great Gatsby in a hammock on the rear porch with the beautiful pond just a few feet away. Mark and Trey were out there in a boat, quietly fishing for bream, while Denny tended the steaks on the grill. At sunset, a cold wind arrived and the four hunters gathered in the den, where a fire was crackling away. At precisely 8 p.m., they pulled out their new sat tracks and punched in their codes. Everybody pecked in the word clear, including Ahmed in Buffalo, and life was secure. Life was indeed good. Less than 24 hours earlier, they were on the campus, hiding in the dark, nervous as hell, but also loving the thrill of the chase. Their plan had worked to perfection. They had the priceless manuscripts, and soon they would have the cash. That transfer would not be easy, but they would deal with it later. We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of Camino Island by John Gresham. The preceding program was a production of Sight Into Sound Radio.